Hi, I'm Coach John Cook, and this is the Basketball and Life podcast. My guest today is Joe Campoli. Coach C is the retired head coach at Ohio Northern University in Ada, Ohio. I was a student assistant in the ONU program for 4 years as a college student. Two of those years, Coach C was the lead assistant, and two of those years, Coach C was the head coach. This podcast is long overdue, if for no other reason than I believe that when you have a mentor, it's a good idea to honor that mentor while you have the opportunity to do so. Coach turned 80 this past winter. He's been retired since 2010, but what he accomplished in a lifetime at Ohio Northern is hard to quantify. 254 wins in 13 years as a head coach. For 17 years before that, he was the lead assistant in the program. Won nearly 300 games during that time. He led Ohio Northern University to Division III Men's National Championship in his first full season as the head coach. And those are the things that you can quantify. What's difficult to measure is the impact that he had on the lives of every player that played for him. Many of the lives of the people that coached against him, and people like me. I was a student assistant. I was a manager in his program, and I count myself incredibly blessed to have been a part of that program, and even more so blessed to have coached as a part of my life for the last 30-plus years since I was in college. I hope you enjoyed today's visit, and just remember that if you have a mentor, someone that you believe is a national treasure, find a way to honor him if you can. That's really what today's episode is about. Enjoy my conversation with Coach Campoli, the retired head basketball coach at Ohio Northern University. Coach, I appreciate you taking time to sit down with me this morning. I know we've had a lot of conversations over the years, and I was blessed to work in your program as a college student. I've been blessed to call you a friend for close to 30 years now. And so a lot of this podcast has been about coaches telling their stories. I don't want to necessarily spend the whole time that we're here together just telling your story, but I want to tell a lot of it, and then I want to talk coaching with you in general. So for those who don't know, and I think a lot of Northwest Ohio people are very familiar with your story, but outside of this immediate area, they may not be. You were the assistant coach at Ohio Northern University for 17 years when Gail Doherty was the head coach. And after 17 years, he retired, became the athletic director, and you got an opportunity to be the head coach. But your coaching journey started well before you got to Ohio Northern University. If you wouldn't mind, just talk a little bit about what led you into coaching to start with and your journey to get to Ohio Northern.
Well, when I was in the sixth grade, a gentleman came to be our head coach and teach English, and I fell in love with this guy, and I wanted to be like him. I wanted to coach and teach. And so I went to the University of Rhode Island and spent 4 years trying to be a phys ed teacher. And my former coach was a superintendent at a high school, different high school than where I played. And he hired me to coach basketball, and assistant coach. At the same time, he was hiring Gail Doherty to be the head coach. And Gail and I hooked up, roomed together. And after a year, he met his wife, threw me out, and he went back to West Point to work for Bob, and I took over for him. And I remained there 11 years, and I was one of the coaches in college. And when he gave me the opportunity, you know, to come to the ONU, I jumped on it. Took a big pay cut. We had just moved into a brand new home. I had a wife and two kids, and it was a tough bullet to bite, but I did it. And I'm not sorry I did it. I think things worked out well for me and my family.
If you had known where coaching was going to lead you when you started, is college coaching, would it have always been your dream? I mean, I know we've talked, it's not easy now. It's almost impossible now to make the jump from high school to college. But back in the 60s and 70s, it was a little bit of an easier process. But even at that, you had spent 11 years as a head high school coach. Were you able to stay focused on your goal of getting to college at that time? How did you manage to spend 11 years at a high school and still believe that coaching in college was possible?
Well, I tried to move even during those 11 years. And I had some really good coaches called for me, you know, for jobs. But and unless a coach knows you, you know, there's just the odds of getting hired aren't very good. They like people who they know the system. They don't have to teach, you know. So it is difficult. But I went after a lot of them and had some great recommendations. But I never, you know, I always wanted to be a college coach.
You have any of those experiences that stand out to you that you know, where who ended up in those spots and what that ended up becoming?
Well, one was at the Naval Academy. When Gail left the Naval Academy, he highly recommended me. And I went down and I thought the interview went well, but he hired a gentleman that had Division I experience recruiting, coaching. That's what you're up against all the time.
Opportunities that develop into something that becomes a job after 11 years. You had mentioned before during our conversation, you felt like you kind of knew that if you were going to get your opportunity, it was going to be because of Coach D.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that day came and it worked out for me. You know, I had an opportunity to work at a great university, great kids. You know, what more can you, you don't make a lot of money, but you know, you deal with good kids.
Right.
And when you look back, the wins and losses at this level don't mean that much. I honestly couldn't tell you right now, John, how many wins I had. It's a little over 200, I think.
254, I think,
See,
Coach.
I didn't know that.
I think that's right.
You know, there's a bunch of losses in there too, but I'm kind of proud of the program that we ran. I think high school coaches respected how we handled kids, what we promised kids. That's really been, you know, something I'm kind of proud of, is that the high school coaches had a lot of respect for our program.
When I was in your program as a student assistant, the program was built primarily on the identity of, that we were defensive-minded. I think from a standpoint of how we developed our program while I was there, it was very much about basic drill work and repetition that created habits so that we were largely prepared for every circumstance. That's how we did things. In fact, I came very, very close to naming my podcast A Buddy in a Ball. Because that was how we got into zigzag every day. Get a buddy in a ball, and we were going to get into our zigzag drill. And I came really close to naming the podcast A Buddy in a Ball, because whoever I'm talking to is a buddy, and we're talking ball. But it was not – when I say this, I hope it's received the way that I intend it. There wasn't anything that we did that was incredibly complicated, but it was incredibly consistent. It was incredibly detail-driven, and – the expectations and demands were really high.
Well, the essence of this, the program goes back to Gail being with a gentleman named Tate Slock at West Point, and a guy named Al LaBalbo who coached in Jersey. That's where all this man-to-man stuff got started. And, you know, that's what Gail learned. Mm-hmm. And that's what he taught me. And, you know, he was with Knight and, it was a successful way to do things. But the essence of our program was repetition. The key to learning is repetition. You do something over and over and over, it becomes a habit. So if you want kids to do something in a game, you better do it every day in practice. And that philosophy, that way of thinking was very good for us. And the kids bought into it. But I'll say this, we won. And winning cures a lot of problems. There's a tendency for kids to buy into what you're trying to do if they're winning. When you're losing, they wonder. Because most kids point the finger, not the thumb. And
it
was a good philosophy for us.
Well, and you mentioned winning. I mean, you mentioned you don't know how many career wins you had. I think 254 is the right number. Coach Doherty won over 300 games in his 20 years as a head coach. You were with him for all but a couple of those seasons. And so that's a lot of wins in a 20-year or an 18-year time period. 17 years, I think you were the assistant in a 17-year time period. That's a lot of wins. The interesting thing that I've never asked you that I always kind of wondered about is when you spend 17 years as an assistant and then you get the opportunity to become a head coach, I think we all have ideas of what we will do different when we go from being an assistant to being the head coach. What was the difference that you didn't anticipate? What changed for you when you became the head coach that maybe you didn't realize was going to be quite as different as it was?
Well, I think we played a little faster. That was probably the big thing. I had nothing against the way we played because we won. There's a lot of ways to skin a cat. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you got to take a look at the players. And when you got a kid like DeArtis Jones, Aaron Madry, Gooden, you look at all these kids on the same team, you got to play up to their strengths. And, a lot of people don't know this, but when Coach had Al Donhoff and Charlie Just, do you know they averaged almost 80 a game?
I do. I knew that, but a lot of people don't know that.
They don't know that. They think, they were 40 a game. It's not, those kids ran up and down the floor. The biggest change would have been offensively. Defensively, I did everything he taught me to do. And thank God the kids bought into it. And I think they bought into it because we won. It's not an easy league to coach in. When I look back and I look at the guys, I was a young coach and I'm looking at Burson with 500 wins, Bankson with 500 wins, John Hill with 300 wins, Mike Moran with 300. I'm like, wow.
Mike Moran at John Carroll, Jim Burson at Muskingum, Steve Bankson at Baldwin Wallace.
Dick Reynolds at Otterbein. I'm thinking, these guys, there's thousands of wins here. And maybe kind of nervous. But once the artists and Adjie moved in, I lost a little bit of that nervousness, I think.
Well, and so you mentioned, you had been a head high school coach for 11 years, and then you joined Gale at Northern and were an assistant for 17. So 17 years between the last time you were a head coach and the first time you are one, it's at a different level. It's at an established program. You told a story once about we all know historically, if you follow the program, you won a national title in your first year as a head coach. You're one of only two or three guys in the history of college basketball that have done that. But you told me a story once about your last year as a head high school coach and your first year as a college coach and kind of what you went through and how drastic the difference was.
Well, my last year at high school, I was 0-18, and I submitted my resignation, and the school wouldn't accept it. So I resigned anyway. And I came here, and when I was a head coach in 93, we went 18-0. So I went from 0-18 to 18-0.
I don't know that anybody. You got to be one of one in that category. Now you did win your first 18 that year before we got knocked off. I think up at Hiram, yes. That broke the streak, and then our only other loss was in the OAC tournament.
Yes,
in the OAC semifinals, and go on to win a national title. Now there are a bazillion stories to be told. I've heard most of them. I live nearly all of them. Just being around the edges of the program. And when you look back on that now, with 30 years after the fact, you mentioned before that the wins and losses aren't important. You wouldn't give back the national title, but I don't think the trophy is the thing that you remember, right?
Not really. The thing I remember is having an opportunity to be around the kind of kids we had, the opportunity to coach those kids. Nobody in Ada knows how many ones I had, nor do they care, but the thing I look back on is the opportunity to coach the quality of kid that came through this program. We had very few problems, we didn't have a lot of problems with kids. They stayed, I'm sure God only knows what they did, that I don't know about, but they stayed out of trouble. For the most part, we all graduated.
And the interesting thing is, I said before, we were a very detail-driven program. I think we did things the right way from the perspective of how we taught. Obviously, it was the only thing I knew when I left college. But you guys also had kind of an interesting philosophy. It's not like we had a whole four pages worth of rules for our guys to follow. We really didn't operate that way. So when you talk about the quality of kids that we had and the fact that they weren't in trouble, what do you attribute it to when you can't say, well, you know, here's what we laid out for them that they, because we really didn't have a lot of quote unquote team rules. We didn't do that.
Well, I think that all started with Gale. Kids had to keep their hair trimmed. They all had to wear the same shoes. There was no jerseys on the jerseys. There was no facial hair. When the season was over, they could have facial. There was no earrings. He set the tone for discipline.
Mm-hmm.
We always had a saying, you know, don't be on time, be early. And that bus, if I say that bus is leaving at 1 o'clock to go to Audubon, we're leaving at one. Now, the big joke is we'd all get on the bus and I'd say, is the artist on the bus? And the kids would all laugh. But I think it all started with Gale setting a discipline, setting the discipline. And the kids accepted it. And hey, you want to play here, you got to cut your hair. You know, you got to do this. You can't have earrings. But we were up front with kids before they came here. And that, I think, was a big key to our program, is our honesty with the kids.
Mm-hmm.
We never, ever promised a kid he was going to start. He was going to make the varsity. We told him we'd keep 22 kids. If you're one of the 22, you'll be in the program. If you're one of the top 14, you'll be in a varsity. If not, you'll be in a gym. But we told them all that. A good example is Jeremy Thompson, visited three times. The third time we sat together at the cafeteria, he says, Coach, Heidelberg promised me I'd start as a freshman. I said, Jeremy, and you don't have a choice. You have to go to Heidelberg. I said, because I can't promise you that. I have 20 other kids that want to start. I haven't seen you play against these kids. I said, you probably need to go to Heidelberg. You came here anyway. And, you know, I think he's still a leading scorer in the history of the place. You know, he had a great career here. Our honesty with the kids was, and the high school coaches knew that. They knew that we didn't promise their kid anything. It worked out for us.
Well, and I think sometimes it's overlooked. I mean, it's easy to remember that you took over the program in the 92-93 season. It's easy to remember that you won a national title in your first year, but you also had a run. I mean, to be honest, 93-94, my last year with the program wasn't a great year. We had a winning record, but it wasn't a great year. But not wasn't long in that 95, 96, 97 on through the early 2000s, you went to another Final Four. I don't know how many OAC players of the year you had. Recruiting to a place like Ohio Northern, Division III, no scholarships. It's obviously not a cheap place to come to school. Talk a little bit about, you already mentioned the honesty with which you approach the communication with kids. How did you create an idea for what you wanted to sell in terms of recruiting? Because it's, again, they got to pay to come to school.
Well, you know, having engineering and pharmacy certainly helped. The thing with us was to try to take kids that we thought could be successful academically, which is why I think, you know, pretty much every kid graduated.
Yeah.
In 30 years, that's a pretty good record. So again, it just goes back to kids knowing where they stand, not promising, you know. If you don't deliver, you promise and you don't deliver, you're done. If you tell a kid he's going to play right away and he doesn't, that high school coach doesn't send you another kid. Now, if you have scholarships, you could go back to that school because some kid will take that scholarship.
Right.
But without scholarship, I'm not going to answer that.
All right, I'll go ahead and we'll just pause real quick. I just want to take a quick second and interrupt the podcast for a minute to remind you that our new platform for the podcast is Spotify for Podcasters. And if you're listening on Spotify, you have an opportunity to make a donation to the podcast if you would be inclined to do so. Thanks for considering any sort of donation. One-time, monthly, or other regular donations are certainly welcome. Spotify for Podcasters is our platform, and they're providing an easy option for you to do so just by clicking the link at the end of the episode. Thanks for your consideration, and now back to the podcast. So when you recruit to a place like this 25 years ago versus now, do you think anything would change if you were recruiting to Northern now in the landscape that we're in with the higher price of education, with the, there's just a different feel around the game. I often wanted to ask you this. If you were starting today at Ohio Northern and you had to go about the recruiting approach, would anything be different now than the way you did it 20, 25 years ago?
I don't think so, John. I had fun recruiting for Ohio Northern. Number one, I thought I had the best product. If you're a car salesman and you think that your car is better than everybody else's car, that's an easy sell. And that's how I felt. I felt like, you know, I used to feel sorry for kids that chose to go elsewhere. I'm thinking, God, why would you pass up an opportunity to be at Ohio Northern? And I don't think that would change today. I still think it's one of the best jobs in the country. Did they make some decisions coaching-wise? I don't know. Did these guys maybe not get good enough players? I don't know. But I still think it's a great job.
So let me get your take on that specific thing, because Coach Doherty was the head coach for 20 years. You were the head coach for 13 years. That's two coaches in 33 years. When you retired, they hired your assistant, Jeff Coleman, and Jeff was here for, I think it was five or six seasons?
4 years.
4 seasons as the head coach. Now, that's three guys in just shy of 40 years leading the program. Since Jeff left the program, I think they're on their fourth guy, right?
Yes.
Coach Rhodes, Coach Byrne, Coach Bensman, and now Coach Young. I think for a lot of people, there's a question of, you know, how does that happen? Number one. Number two, maybe it's a different era, maybe it's a different time. How do we get back to stability, which I think in any program is important?
Well, when a job opens up at Duke, somebody from Duke's getting that job. Happened to be John Shire. If it wasn't John, it was probably going to be Tommy Amaker. They didn't do that here. Is that good or bad? I don't know. You know, it could be good or bad. I like to see schools hire someone who knows the place, knows the professors, knows the value system. You know, John was a great person. John wanted to go back to Division I, which he did.
Right.
They get people involved hiring it. I sometimes wonder, what makes this person qualified to hire? Kevin Burns is a great guy. They saw he was from MIT, and everybody went nuts. Oh, my God, this guy's from MIT, you know. Great academic. Well, you know, didn't work out. So then comes Benz. And I think Benz was an easy hire for them. He was already here. He had won a state title. The kids liked him. I just throw that out. I'm not sure if it's been the hiring, but I'll go to my grave knowing that I think this is a great job, you know, to this day.
And the stability factor, it's something now that maybe has an opportunity to get, quote unquote, reestablished. Now you've got a guy with Division III experience in Coach Young. Neil Young is fairly early in his coaching career, but got a remarkably high level of coaching experience, NAIA and Division III. You know, I'm a believer that Division III is Division III. It's a unique college level of basketball on a lot of fronts. And you mentioned it. I mean, not every guy that coaches college basketball is necessarily going to be a Division III college coach. We've been very fortunate at Ohio Northern in my time to have guys who were Division III guys, and Coach Young, I think, maybe is a Division III guy, gives some stability maybe back to the program. I asked you about recruiting. Let me ask you now about coaching. Today, I don't know anybody that watches more college basketball than you do. From the time the season starts to the time the season ends, you watch a lot of college basketball. It's undeniable that the game is different now than the game was when you started coaching it, and it's probably considerably different than it was when you stopped coaching it at the college level. When you watch the game today and see the way that it gets played and the way that teams play it, I guess first question is, what's your take on the way the game has evolved and the way it gets coached and played today?
Well, I think what's happened is people want to see 100 points on the board. It's strictly, and I see shots taken in games, I shake my head. What would possess him to take that shot? But that's what people want to see. The game has gone from defense to offense. No doubt in my mind. It's become an offensive way of playing the game. And it's different.
So if you were going to begin coaching it today, I guess two questions or two-part question. What would you do differently than you used to do? Or if you were going to try to model yourself after the way someone plays it or a coach the way he does it, who would you kind of look at as maybe an example that you might be able to draw from?
I don't think I'd change. I think within the next year or two, the shot clock's going to 24. That makes the game a little different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, by the time you get the ball up the floor, you're looking at 20 seconds, 19 seconds. I would try to do the same things. If I had to change, I'm not sure what it would be other than play a little faster maybe or get more quick shots. I don't know, to be honest with you.
You follow the college game pretty closely and you've got relationships with
thousands of college games, and I see teams come off the floor and take jump shots one on none.
Are there programs playing today or guys coaching today that when you watch their teams, you admire what they do, or you feel like that's maybe the best, a better way to do it than you see other guys doing it?
That's the way kids want to play.
Yeah.
Kids want to play. That's why the transfer portal is what it is. Kids aren't going to sit anymore. They're going where they can play. They said on TV that Villanova will start three transfers next year. I found that astounding. A program with that stature, you got to depend on some kid coming from, one's coming from Maryland. It blows my mind.
It's going. I still think with college basketball coach, at the end of the day, the people that play it, particularly at the Division III level, but college basketball across the board, it's still a very small number of them who are going to turn it into a career after college. And you had a son that played college basketball. You coached for 30 years at the college level. How many of your guys went on to play professionally at any level? A small handful, maybe?
Went to Europe. Not obviously in NBA, you know.
Right. But yet you've still got an endless list of guys with successful lives and careers after this. I guess that the point I was trying to get to is, it's what do you take away from basketball college basketball, besides the basketball part, that has the longest lasting impact
Absolutely.
On your life?
We have 13 engineers on our national championship team. We have 7 just in Columbus right now. That's something I'm proud of, you know. They weren't all great players, but they had a role to play here, and they're doing well.
If a young prospective coach came to you today or this week or next week and said, you know, coach, I'm leaving high school, I'm going to college, but I really want to be a college coach, what kind of advice or what might you say to that young person?
Well, it's interesting you ask me that, because I do get calls from young coaches that want to sit down and talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell them all the same thing. I talk about repetition, number one. I talk about not, you know, not selling them a bundle. Be truthful to the kid. Those are the two things I try to impress young coaches on, is be honest with the kids, let them know where they stand. And I think from a playing standpoint, I think repetition is the key to learning. Yeah, there's a lot of ways to skin a cat. Some people run, some people walk it up the floor, you know, whatever. Makes no difference. Just do it every day. You'll get good at it. It doesn't matter what you do. You'll get good at anything you do if you do it every day. And that's the advice I would give kids. Corey Harvey is an assistant. You know Corey?
At Heidelberg, correct?
Yeah, he's at Heidelberg. Yeah. And he called me one day on the phone. I have no idea who this kid was. He said, "Coach, would you sit down and talk to me about coaching in college?" I said, "Absolutely." And we met in town at 101. I sat there for an hour and a half with he and his dad, telling him what I thought he needed to do. Go to clinics, work camps, get yourself, surround yourself with, go to practices. That's what I would tell a kid.
Do you think, and we talked about it earlier in the podcast, but just a kid who starts at the high school level into coaching. I know that over the course of your time at Northern, you watched high school coaches that you felt like could be good college coaches. Is it a transition that can be made today if you go the high school route first, or are you better off to get into grad school, get into a graduate assistantship, and pursue college from the very beginning?
I don't think starting out in high school is a bad thing if you know people at the next level that have enough confidence in you. And, they may ask you to join their staff. So it could work both ways, You just never know.
That's for sure.
Come to our camp, Mike Young. Mike, we asked him to speak to the camp one day and he refused. He doesn't like to get in front of groups. We understood that. He's the head coach of Virginia Tech. Jim Woolridge came here. He ended up at Kansas State.
Mm-hmm.
There's
been a lot of guys come through the camps for sure.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about that. Now, was you and Coach D that started the camp together, right? The camp didn't exist before you got here, did it?
He had it for 1 year.
Okay. So talk about the beginning of camp and now what the evolution of summer basketball has done to kind of eliminate what we built, what we had here at Northern.
Well, Gale sat down with a guy named Al Van Wee from Worcester.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, Worcester was running a great camp. And that's where Gale was trying to get to, which he gives Al credit for. I think the days of the instructional camps are over, and that's a sad thing, because I think the kids learned some things when they came to our camp. A lot of teams came back year after year after year, won big and high, would win in high school, but kids just want to play. They just want to run up and down and play. So now you're looking at shootouts. What is it, team camps, shootouts? I'm not even sure you could start an instructional camp today, to be honest with you. I don't know if it would go or not.
It seems to me that there are a smaller number of colleges that have them. Some who have them are doing well. I think Capitals is doing fairly well. I went down to Otterbein last week just to stick my head in. See, they had about 150 kids, but it was day camp. It was parents dropped the kids off at like 9 a.m., picked them up at 4. What you guys did here was multiple weeks, overnight camp, 200-300 kids at a camp 4 or 5 weeks in a summer.
I think those days are over, unfortunately. I know when we first had a team camp at Northern, I was determined I was going to give a morning lecture and an afternoon lecture. And the coaches went nuts. They didn't want me to lecture. They wanted to play.
They want to play.
And that was it. That ended the lectures. And they just played. And then the AAUs, of course, took over basketball as well. So
in your time doing this, now I feel like most every college coach at every level builds their July calendar around seeing AAU events. Were you involved in getting out to AAU events to see kids
play? There really wasn't a lot of AAA back then. It's funny because I remember having a discussion one time. I was on the phone with Jay Wright when he was at the Hofstra. And he said, I got to run. I'm meeting a high school coach for lunch. He said, which I do probably 3 to 4 times a week. And we hung up and I'm thinking, wow, you know. But you got to get to know these guys because they influence kids where they go.
Mm-hmm.
My last couple of years at Northern, we'd send a kid a questionnaire to fill out, and where it said high school coach, he'd put down as a AAU coach. I'm thinking, he's not your coach, you know.
So you didn't experience the building of relationships with those summer guys, which is something now I think that a lot of coaches are experiencing more, that they've got to get connected to not just the high school coach, but the AAU coach as well. If you would, talk a little bit from your experience about the fine line between a Division III player, a scholarship player that's maybe NAIA versus Division II versus Division I, because I think a lot of times – people get stuck with this idea that they have to get a scholarship without realizing just what it means to be a college player and how good you have to play college, good you have to be to play college at any level.
Well, if you want to play at a high level, scholarship level, you're going to know by the time you're a sophomore, because schools are going to be, they don't sit around and wait anymore. They're offering kids as low as eighth graders. I think the biggest difference is size, the size of kids between a 3 and a 2 and a 3, 2 and 1.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is in most sports. I look at a lot of baseball now that the World Series is on, and the size of these kids, they're all 6'3", 6'4", 200. I'm thinking, wow, our kids are 5'8", 5'9", 5'10", 165. So size is a big factor, I think.
I agree, 1,000%. I Mark Gooden, when he played here one time, said, because his brother Scott played Division I, played at the University of Akron. And he said Mark's feeling was from Division III to Division I, it's about 2 inches in height. And it's about 2 steps in quickness. And that's what separates Division I from Division III. Now, that's not a lot. You're talking in general across the board, position by position, a couple of inches in height, a couple of steps in quickness, and it changes the game. And I just feel like there's so much of a rush to cast aside what it is to be recruited by a Division III school for a lot of kids and their families because, again, the scholarship is the thing that they envision as the issue. But playing college basketball, you have to be really, really good. You mentioned Jeremy Thompson before. Kevin Sensabaugh played here. You had really good players here. Jim Conrad had a great career here. Not one of those guys at the time he was finished here couldn't have played at a Finley or at a Division II school and maybe even that lower level Division I, but this is where they belong.
Well, this is where they belong when they're freshmen. There's kids that turn themselves like a Stan Morey's. And Stan was a senior. He could play for Bowling Green, I tell you right now, But coming out of high school, he couldn't.
Right.
And that's the big thing.
So I've talked to a couple of coaches. There's a really young new head coach in the area that I spent time with in the last couple of weeks and talked about meeting with his guys and explaining to them that my job is to either develop you to the point where I can't keep you off the floor or to recruit better players than you. When you had your roster put together and you were building your team, do you feel like you focused more on trying to recruit the next kid that was a little better than what was on your roster? Or was it more important to develop the guys that you had and watch them reach their potential?
Well, probably a combination of the two would be my guess. You're always looking to get better. You're not going to get much better than DeArtis Jones, Aaron Madry, Mark Gooden, those are CJ Napier, I think, is a big, pretty good, was a pretty good catch for a Division III school. There were some twos interested in him. So some kids over time can do. In fact, I think CJ is going to walk on at Dayton.
That'll be interesting to
tell. Or try at least.
Yeah, sure.
I'm sure he'll. Yeah, he's not giving him a scholarship. What's he have to lose? Let the kid try on, you know, try out. So.
Player development, it's almost become like a small industry in basketball now. Guys doing individual training and working with individual players to develop their skill set. When you look back on your time at Northern, when the off season hit, talk a little bit about what it was that you guys provided to your players as an expectation for them when they – this is your summer. When you come back to school, were there specific position-based workouts? What did you guys do to try and keep your focus on skill development with your guys?
Well, we met with every player at the end of the season and spent considerable time with them. And we told them what you got to do to improve. You know, if you're going to play next year, this is what you need to do. Again, it goes back to being honest with kids. You're not going to get better going from sophomore to junior year just because you went from your sophomore to junior. You're going to get better if you do something, you know, in between. But we sat down with the kids and tried to be very honest about what they had to do in the summer, you know, to get better. You know, some did it, some didn't. You know, you could tell the kids that worked out, the kids that didn't work out. And, you know, sometimes it works out for us. Sometimes it doesn't. You know,
it worked out for most of your guys.
Absolutely.
Most of your guys, it worked out for very well. We're in the end of the summer now, looking ahead to what's ahead. I don't know. I guess as you sit back now and you watch the game the way that you do, you watch it here at the place that you coached, you watch it across the country, what's your overall take on where college basketball as a whole is? I know we talked about the transfer portal and the NIL stuff, the money stuff, just the basketball itself. What is your perception of where the game is, and how do you feel about the game now compared to maybe when you did when you walked away from coaching?
Well, at the one level, I don't like the direction it's going. They're paying kids. Kids are transferring. I think Division I basketball is in trouble. I think within 3 to 4 years, it's going to be 3 or 4 teams that just dominate every year because they have the money to do that. That I don't like. I don't see a lot of change in Division III. It's pretty much on a hasn't changed a lot. Some schools, you know, going with black kids, that's helped them. I still think Division III is a little bit more about academics than two and one, and I think that's a good thing. I'd like to see Division III separate from two and one. I don't think we need a 24-second clock. Yeah, to me, a 40-second clock would be I could live with.
It was 45 when it started for us.
Yes.
And it went to 35.
Yeah.
It feels pretty inevitable. I mean, the women are already playing at 30, and then the men at 30. It feels pretty inevitable that the men will end up at 24.
Well, Division I's want 24.
Right.
Because now a Fairfield can't come in and beat you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Akron can't come in and beat Duke at Duke with a 24-second clock. No way. They have the talent, you know. So I see it going in that direction. Of course, guys like Mike Krzyzewski want a 20. He's for it.
Well, sure.
I know why he's
more
for it.
More possessions for his guys.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's got the better players.
Just a couple minutes here, and we'll kind of wrap things up. Last kind of question I have for you is, now that you've got so much in the rear view, but you're still such a big fan of the game, is there anything that, what is it that you enjoy most about watching the game today? Because we've talked about the things that aren't very enjoyable. What do you enjoy most about the game today?
Well, everybody's playing the same way. And it's kind of interesting to watch, particularly defensively, because I know what we tried to do. And now I'm watching what they're trying to do. And it's been interesting. There's a contrast there.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Offensively, it's like, wow. Just run the first good shot. They fire that thing, man. You know, time and score means nothing today. Absolutely nothing. People have a 20-point lead and they're playing like they're up 50 and can't get beat, and they get beat. They think nothing of the clock, the score, you know, nothing changes. And I notice it throughout the whole country, because I'm watching basketball all day long, and it's crazy how that happens.
Well, Coach, I really appreciate your time. I don't want to keep you any longer. We got a lot of things to get to. Thanks so much for sitting down with me today.
Enjoyed it very much. I appreciate you taking the time.
Hi, I'm Coach John Cook, and this is the Basketball and Life Podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in and checking this one out. If you're listening on Spotify, courtesy of our platform, Spotify for Podcasters, you have the opportunity to make a donation to the podcast. If you would be inclined to do so, there's a link at the bottom of the episode that will allow you to make your donation in whatever amount you would choose to do so. If you're listening on any other platform, I just ask that you please rate, review, and subscribe, and come back anytime to check out more episodes here on the Basketball and Life Podcast.